From KMXT in Kodiak, this is the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Kayla DeRoche. Coming up this week, a Yale student is looking into whether or not jellyfish affect Bering Sea fisheries. Also, Alaska Fish Radio's Lainey Welch sits down with the Alaska Fisheries Report to catch up on the 2016 Gulf of Alaska Pink Salmon Fishery Disaster Declaration funding and Atlantic halibut, among other things. That and more coming up on this week's Alaska Fisheries Report.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report is provided by the Stosh and Claudia Anderson Fund, supporting conservation and harvesting of Alaska's wild, sustainable fisheries.
Do jellyfish affect Bering Sea fisheries? And if so, how? That's what Yale University's Jonathan Rutter wants to find out. The college senior is conducting a survey to learn more about the gelatinous creatures directly from fishermen.
What are the impacts that jellyfish have on Bering Sea fisheries? And those impacts sort of could be economic or nuisance-based or anything like that. I'm going in it with a pretty open mind.
The threat posed by jellyfish has been documented outside the Bering Sea. For example, Rutter says large jellyfish blooms became a huge nuisance for fishermen in the Sea of Japan in the early 2000s by damaging gear. One study estimated they lost more than $60 million in revenue. Scientists have studied jellyfish in the Bering Sea as well, but Rutter says no one has really quantified their impact on commercial fishing.
If jellyfish really aren't that impactful at the end of the day, which I think is actually fairly likely, that also matters because these scientists keep saying that it might be without really having any solid data to stand on with that claim. And so I think that will also benefit the fishing community as a whole.
Rutter's anonymous survey asks fishermen to respond to statements like, "My vessel frequently catches jellyfish while fishing for our target species," and "My vessel loses potential catch because of jellyfish." The questionnaire takes 10 minutes to complete, and he says fishermen don't have to worry about sharing the tricks of the trade.
All of those questions are going to be completely disconnected from any conclusions I come up with at the end of the day. They're not going to be attached to any identifiers.
Rutter says he's hoping to poll as many fishermen as possible to collect the best data. His study is part of a growing movement in the research community to consider local expertise alongside scientific data.
Social scientists make a point of considering local opinions and that sort of thing, but the two communities don't interact enough, in my opinion. I think scientific data is meaningless if it's not grounded in personal experience, and scientists definitely have a tendency to sort of get wrapped up in their own world and in their models.
Rutter hopes that if jellyfish really are significant, then he'll be able to suggest things to make life easier for fishermen and help sustain their catches.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is supported, in part, by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
For this week's Alaska Fisheries Report, we sit down with longtime fisheries journalist Lainey Welch, who produces Alaska Fish Radio. We chat about some of the fisheries issues affecting Kodiak, the Gulf of Alaska, and the state at large. That includes the disaster declaration for the 2016 Gulf of Alaska pink salmon season, which recently won federal relief funds, and the possible future disaster declaration for the 2018 Pacific cod fishery in the Gulf of Alaska. In the last year or so, it's been a pretty rough season for a couple of different fisheries, including pinks, cod. We've got a really difficult season. We had a declaration recently for the fisheries disaster.
So here we went from the pink no-show in 2016. The cod disaster hits us, well, in place now, but we found out about that last year. Now we're finding that halibut is going to be way down, so that's going to be another hit.
Right, and we just got funding for the pink salmon season. And then for cod, we may not get it, but we have a possible declaration in the future. Like you saw that letter that the governor drafted to the federal government.
And, of course, there's no time frame. And then, again, how do we define who's eligible? It's not only, of course, the fishermen who can show X percent of their income was based on pecod, but then we also have the processing plant workers and, you know, just trickles all down the line.
Yeah, that's something I'm really curious about for the pink salmon funding is where is that going to go? Is it going to communities to disperse it? Is it going to individuals? What's the standard for a claim?
Like, how
much money do you have to have lost?
Yeah, is it dependent on your historical catches, for example? Who knows? And is the same formula applied to pink salmon eligibility as it is to peacock? I don't know the answers to that.
Right. And also, cod is apparently a little bit different because the pink salmon declaration was after the season was so terrible, whereas with cod, it's before it closed.
Right. So and looking out for several years ahead even.
Right. They think that's going to be a multi-year issue.
Right.
And by they, I mean people like Barbara Blake in the governor's office. And then to make it a more complicated situation, we have this halibut issue going on. So could you talk about that?
Well, of course, the stocks are continuing to decline and will into the foreseeable future. That's a given. That's bad enough. But then last year, for the first time in as many years as I can remember, all of a sudden, this Atlantic halibut started to flood the market. Traditional markets that we'd be sending our Pacific fish to, you know, all along the eastern seaboard and et cetera. And so that's another wrinkle in the upcoming fishery. You know, not only are the catches going to be down, the prices are likely to be down. Of course, that's all relative. They'll be very high, the first deliveries, as always. And then after a week or two, the market will settle out. And things will be a little bit more realistic. But I think, you know, it's always tricky to go out on a limb and talk prices. But I think the days of $7 halibut at the docks are gone by, at least for now. Especially, I mean, of course, less fish, you know, the laws of supply and demand, sometimes that will serve to boost to the price. But if you've got this extra product coming in from the other coast, it's cheaper because it's closer to the market. You know, that's also going to be something that Alaska fishermen will have to compete with. But then on the other hand, we have, you know, new crab fisheries popping up. We've got squid showing up in Alaska. You know? So it's tough to determine. And I think we're heading into a pretty good salmon season. Pinks are always the hardest to predict. And I'm hearing some early, you know, concerns about a good pink run. But I'm primarily hearing that the markets are very strong. It's still early. All that March kind of marks the time when we start getting all of that preseason salmon information.
As far as the halibut numbers go, have you seen a drop like this for a while, or is this pretty consistent with other decreases?
Well, it's been for about 20 years, the stocks have just been slowly ratcheting down up until last year. The halibut commissioners raised the catch limit slightly, you know, by, you know, maybe 1 million pounds for Alaska. And then immediately after doing that, you know, they were sort of smacking their heads going, oh, what have we done? You know? And so I think, you know, everybody left the meeting last year thinking, oh, the catch limits are too high. We're heading for trouble. And here we are.
That was Alaska Fisheries Report talking with Lainey Welch, who produces Alaska Fish Radio.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
The Alaska Innovators Hall of Fame recently inducted its first indigenous tool. Few people still use the hand-carved halibut hook, once popular with Southeast tribes. But there's a push to make sure the tradition sticks around for future generations. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has the story.
Standing with his grandson at the Juneau Innovation Summit a few weeks ago, Thomas George accepted an award.
I've been trying to get help to keep this part of our heritage alive for years or decades.
The Alaska State Committee on Research gives credit to people and inventions which have made a lasting impact in the state. George accepted the honor for a collective achievement, the halibut hook, which has been used by Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian people for thousands of years. Even though the technology is old, George says it isn't a relic.
Over the years, everybody thought it was a decoration for the wall, but my hooks never did hang on the wall. They hung out on the porch.
George only knows one other person in Southeast Alaska who fishes with the traditional halibut hook, and he's a big proponent for bringing them back. He's taught classes at the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute on how to make them. Growing up in Klawak, he says carving the hooks was part of his childhood. His grandmother was one of the people who passed on the knowledge. And he remembers some advice she gave him. All of the measurements you need to know are in your own hand.
If you got small hands, you don't need a big fish.
Typically, people jig for halibut on their boat using a metal circle hook. But the traditional design and method is different. The hook itself is shaped like a V, with a more buoyant wood like yellow cedar on one side and a denser wood on the other. This makes it float in a certain direction. And George says the best part about fishing this way is you can set the line in the water and come back later. It's suspended by floats.
You could go to the beach and build a fire and boil coffee.
Before he sets the hooks, George talks to them.
Telling them that she's coming down to fight.
Each of his hooks is named after a different girlfriend, which he admits can sometimes be confusing.
It's getting harder to remember all my girlfriend's names, blanket names, so catching less and less fish.
But over the years, he says, there have been plenty of fish in the sea. Just one hook alone, he estimates, has caught about 800 halibut. He says even though the practice is sustainable and effective, fishing the traditional way hasn't always been encouraged. Back in the 1970s, before there were subsistence permits, he invited a state trooper to see the halibut hooks in action. And after about 5 minutes, George had a halibut on the line.
And we rolled him in, and he pulled up beside us, and he says, "My God," he says, "I was going to confiscate your gear and write you a citation, but..." He said that was truly amazing just to witness.
George begged the trooper to write him a citation because he wanted to challenge the issue in court. But the trooper was elated. He never bothered him again. In 2000, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council established a subsistence program for halibut. But George thinks there's still roadblocks to preserving the traditional ways. Having to obtain a subsistence permit at all, he says, creates an additional barrier. And he'd like to see more people use the hand-carved halibut hook.
So that, you know, that part of our heritage does not die.
George wishes the Alaska legislature would address the issue and take it up with the Regional Fishery Management Council. In the meantime, he's doing his part to make sure the next generation knows how to make the traditional hooks. His 14-year-old grandson has already picked up the skill.
Well, he hasn't said much except for let's go fishing.
George says the state recognizes the halibut hook is an important innovation. It's a technology worth keeping around. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you by Commercial Fishermen for Bristol Bay, permit holders and fishing groups standing together to protect and enhance the renewable fishing jobs and businesses of the Bristol Bay region.
And that's all for this week's Alaska Fisheries Report. We had help from the Alaska Energy Desk's Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, KUCB Zoe Sobel in Unalaska, and Alaska Fish Radio's Lainey Welch in Kodiak. From KMXT in Kodiak, I'm Kayla DeRoche.